This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
I'm Heather Brown, and this is the Between the Covers podcast. Time for another episode of The Stone Carvers, Jane Urquhart's sweeping saga of war, remembrance, and art. At this point in the story, Clara Becker and her brother Tillman have been reunited after years of separation. Tillman's stories about his friend Giorgio going to France to work on the war memorial inspired Clara. Both Tillman and Clara could carve, and she feels they must go too. So, disguised as a man, Clara joins her brother on the ship to France, neither of them knowing quite what to expect when they arrive.
After 10 days at sea, Clara saw the coast of France early in the morning through the porthole of the cabin where she and Tillman slept. And as if until that moment she had not believed she would set foot on that soil, she finally made the decision to cut off her hair. With scissors in hand, she made her way to the WC, locked herself in one of the cubicles, and, wincing, began to slice off hunk after hunk, filling her trouser and jacket pockets with skeins of golden hair threaded here and there with silver. When she was finished, she rubbed her head and was surprised to find the beginnings of the curls that, until now, had been straightened by the weight of her long mane. Then she placed the hat on her head and walked out to the deck. At this hour, it was not long before she found a private spot. Using both hands, she tossed her shorn hair into the wind, and though some of it blew back onto the deck, most was swept away from her so quickly, it was as if the elements were hungry, eager to help her assume her new role. When the ship docked in Le Havre, Tillman rose from his bunk, hastily gathered their few belongings, and guided Clara out of the cabin up to the deck. Still holding her arm, he pushed through the crowd and hurried awkwardly down the gangplank. Once they were on the quay, he almost immediately began to talk about nourishment. "Don't worry. I know how to beg in French," he informed his sister. "First house we scrounge some food." "No one is going to beg," said Clara. "If you are hungry, we'll go to a restaurant." "Good idea. Lots of scraps out back." "No, Tillman, we are going right in the restaurant." Tillman stopped walking and looked at her in amazement. "I've never gone into a restaurant." "Neither have I," said Clara. "But I've always wanted to." Clara looked up and down the narrow, unfamiliar street on which they stood. She was unnerved by the strangeness of the architecture, the shutters that seemed to be closed against her, the thick, bolted doors. But she knew she wasn't as frightened as she would have been had she still been dressed as a woman. Eventually, Clara saw a plain painted sign announcing the Hotel Restaurant Richelieu. "Okay, let's go there," she said, pointing. "No," said Tillman, though he sounded less determined. Clara suspected that he was beginning to enjoy being managed. Years later, Clara would say that her brother Tillman, unrepentant hobo, gave up the road because of a humble French restaurant near the docks in Le Havre, a restaurant where he first encountered coquille Saint-Jacques Meunière and jambon d'Alsace à la crème. They stayed that night and slept in a room above the restaurant, descending in the morning for bowls of coffee and milk, served with bread, butter, and gooseberry jam. The patron, who was also the chef, had ceremoniously embraced each of them when he discovered they were Canadians. His eyes filled with tears when he spoke about the war, two sons dead, and every landmark he cared about reduced to ash and dust. "Everyone," he said, "had heard about the great monument being carved at Vimy and about the perfect Yugoslavian stone." There was a train to Amiens and another from there to Arras. Once in Arras, they should stop anyone at all with a horse and a cart, tell them they were Canadians come to work on the great monument, and, he assured them, they would be joyfully delivered to the site. "Couldn't we just stay here for a couple of days?" said Tillman. And then when Clara refused, "How can you just walk away from that fish soup? We could have it again tonight." He was quiet and sulky all the way to the station. As predicted in Le Havre, Tillman quickly located at the market in Arras a farmer with a cart who was delighted by the idea of being able to convey two new workers to the massive sculpture at Vimy 6 miles away. As they got nearer to the site, the terrain through which they rolled became unsettling in its disorder, the farmer pointing out germinating trenches, muddy craters, barbed wire, shell holes. Acres and acres remained fenced off, posted out of human bounds as active shells and mines still littered the surface and hid in the depths of the earth. All this more than 16 years after the troops had gone home, leaving in their wake a torn, unrecognizable landscape, a wind full of ashes and the smell of rotting flesh. The most manicured and orderly spots were now the household gardens and the military cemeteries, though even there the landscaping was in various stages of completion. But the grass that covered the graves was mostly green, ironically unscarred. Tillman would not look at the graveyards, stared straight ahead as they lumbered past these inappropriately tidy reminders of tragedy, these gardens of the dead. Above all this, on the horizon, rose the twin white towers of the monument, their shape distorted by 5-story-high scaffolding and canvas bunting. Clara touched Tillman's arm when the structure first came into view, but he drew away, reminding her that men usually don't touch each other's arm. As they entered the work site, they were amazed by the number of horses, donkeys, the cumbersome cranes and lorries. "Just like the war," Tillman commented. Dressed in the traditional French workers' costume of overalls, jacket, and cap, several dozen men scurried like bright blue beetles along the scaffolding and across the frost-covered mud that surrounded it. The wagon drew up near this, and the farmer turned to them and smiled and nodded. "Much working," he said. Tillman smiled back, descended awkwardly from the vehicle, reached up and quite uncharacteristically shook the man's hand. Then he gave Clara a quick glance. "Let me do the talking," he said, gesturing toward the Quonset hut the farmer had pointed out to them. "I'll get us a job in no time."
"There's another Canadian here," a Captain Simpson informed them. "Only one, Giorgio Vigamonti."
Clara looked warily at the overseer. There was a dismissive, almost pompous practicality about him for which she was grateful. He did not raise his eyes from his desk.
"I know him," said Tillman. "That's why I'm here. That's why we're here, my brother and me." "What kind of experience do you have?"
"I worked with Giorgio, but I'm not as experienced as him." He rapped his wooden leg with his knuckles. "I can't climb," he said.
"I gathered that," said Simpson. "You'll have to work on the details at the base. We need some help there. What's the matter with your brother? Cat got his tongue?"
"Vocal cords destroyed by..." Tillman paused. "A bungled tonsillectomy when he was a kid." Clara could feel her face grow hot. Simpson was looking at her now as if he knew there was something odd here, but he couldn't determine what. He raised his eyebrows.
"What a pair. One can't walk, the other can't talk. What's his work experience?"
"Mostly wood carving. He'd like to be an assistant or something like that. He can do any kind of light manual labor." Simpson examined Clara for a disturbingly long period of time.
"Well, he's small enough to be a good climber. He could go upstairs, plenty of odd jobs up there. And that's where Vigamonti is."
Clara slept in a dormitory Quonset hut in a bunk next to Tillman. 15 other workers shared the space and filled the air at night with muttering and snoring. The waking hours with a cacophony of Italian sounds Clara couldn't understand. Clara's sole knowledge of the male body had come to her as a result of learning Eamon, a pale-skinned, beautifully formed boy with a clear chest and a flat stomach. Now she saw everything that in the past she had only measured for suit jackets, and she saw much more besides. Men with enormous pot bellies and hair covering all of their bodies, and younger men, powerfully but thickly built. Tillman's friend, Giorgio, slept in a much smaller hut next door with the two other carvers who worked in the elevated atelier at the top of the pylon. Clara was grateful for this, as she wanted, for the purposes of maintaining her disguise, no further intimacy with this friend of Tillman. Tillman, sensing her anxiety and acutely aware of his own, had tried to persuade her that they should tell Giorgio who she really was, confess her gender. He is entirely trustworthy, he had explained, and he would look out for her if he knew, would help them keep her secret. But she hadn't liked the idea, and said she wanted to be treated the same as everyone else. Later in the afternoon, Tillman and Clara stood with Giorgio in a crowd of silent workers and watched as the man called Allward unpacked his latest creations. "There'll be hell to pay," Giorgio informed them, "if anything's broken. One of the defenders had his nose knocked off coming over the channel. Allward almost didn't survive that." Walter Allward was brushing straw from the wing of a plaster angel. Behind him, the monument rose like a pale, partly completed cathedral. "Charity," said Giorgio, moving his head to one side to get a better look. "Or hope. I'm one of the angel men," he continued. "I'm going to get to work on them. Look." He pointed at Allward, who had uncrated another winged woman, straw blowing around him as if he were in the center of a small cyclone. "There are certain visual occurrences that become tethered to memory," Clara would later decide. "Images that appear in the mind when one is sitting in waiting rooms or staring out train windows. If they are strong enough, they may bloom in the brain when one is making love, or perhaps, though no one really knows this, a few moments before death." The raising by rope of the white plaster angels up to the elevated studio that was to be their home until they were reinvented in stone was, for her, a masterpiece of shape and motion that she took unknowingly deep into herself. The twisted rope beneath the breasts, the shadows of the wings moving up the marble pylons, the utter silence surrounded her. None of this would ever leave her. She had witnessed an ascension, an apotheosis, an act so fragile its perfection could be shattered by the smallest alteration in the direction of the wind. And when it was over, and she looked at Giorgio, she could see that, like her own, his eyes were full of tears. As the weeks passed, Giorgio instructed Clara, explaining the use of chisels, rasps, and claws, so that eventually she knew automatically which size the men might need, could sense by their posture and gestures when they required a change of gauge. He showed her how to use the pumice to polish finished limbs, always speaking slowly and patiently. One day, shortly after the carvers began to work on the recently arrived angels, Clara whispered to Giorgio that she knew a bit about chisels from wood carving. "Like Tillman," he said. "You had a grandfather who was wonderful, I understand."
"Yes," she whispered. "He taught us when we were quite small children. He had high hopes for Tillman, but after he disappeared."
"Your brother finds it hard to stick," Giorgio said. They had pulled the canvas aside and were sitting at the front door of the studio, thoughtfully chewing on the baguettes they were given for lunch, their legs swinging over emptiness. It was a cold, clear day in early March. They could see as far as Arras. Giorgio exchanged a wave with someone on the ground, then turned back to the person he knew as Carl. "How long do you think he'll stay here?" he asked.
"I hope he'll stay," whispered Clara, not really answering the question. "I hope so."
"Well, I'll be here anyway," said Giorgio. Clara turned to look at him, to study his rectangular-shaped face in profile, the prominent nose and generous mouth. She couldn't remember ever coming to like someone this quickly, this fast. She almost touched his sleeve, the soft plaid flannel that emerged from his blue jacket, and then remembered and pulled back. He glanced at her suddenly, then grinned and scrambled to his feet, oddly light and agile for a man so large. "Back to work," he said.
"Yes," whispered Clara. "Back to work."
Later in the afternoon, Giorgio asked her to work with him in the far corner of the studio, where he'd begun to rough out the left wing of an angel. Clara was to fill a bucket with waste stone, then take it to the canvas door and lower it by a rope to the ground beneath. On one occasion, just before she was to proceed to the door with a full load, she amazed herself by asking Giorgio if he were married.
"Do you have a wife?"
she whispered. I came close once, but it didn't happen. Circumstances, he said slowly. How about you?
No,
she whispered. Tillman never told me he had a brother. You are how old?
39.
Giorgio threw his head back and laughed. I'm 41, he said. We still have lots of time for women, you and I. Clara laughed out loud. Giorgio stared at her, surprised. He turned back toward the sculpture. Clara felt a kind of tense silence settle between them, and she decided from now on to remain as quiet as possible in his presence. But all day long after this, Clara's inner voice continued to speak to her brother's friend. Do you see? She was saying to him in her mind. Do you understand?
Nikki Guadagni, reading episode 12 of The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. In the next episode, Tillman Becker finally finds love, and Clara is drawn to commit an act of such bold disobedience that her future in France may be threatened. The novel is published by Viking Press. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.